We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Untangle. I'm Patricia Karpis. Today's guest, Adam Pierce, has a heartbreaking personal story that has humbled him and changed his life. It's also taught him patience, resilience, and hope, and perhaps given him a deeper experience of love. Most importantly, he's learned the gifts that come from accepting what is, especially when it's out of our control. In 2009, his brother Kevin Pierce, one of the top snowboarders in the world, competing against the likes of Shaun White and often winning, heading into the Olympics, had a tragic accident while training. It left Kevin with a traumatic brain injury, which changed the course of his life and Adam's. Adam shared how he kept going despite sadness and uncertainty, and how both he and Kevin had to reframe their mindset to help the healing process. One doctor told Kevin he'd need to find a way to love your brain. This ultimately became the name of the foundation they formed to help others with traumatic brain injury. Meditation, yoga, compassion, and connection are all at the heart of the foundation. I loved when Adam said that suffering can be a greater pathway to finding meaning and growth. So true. He is quite the amazing guy. As always, we're Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband dedicating to unlocking your brain's potential and revolutionizing health, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. Muse is excited to have partnered with the Love Your Brain Foundation. Now, here's Adam. Adam, it's great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you and your family have been on quite the extraordinary journey. And I would love to hear from you a little bit about your family before we get into what happened and what we're going to talk about today. Tell me a little bit about your family. What was it like growing up with four brothers? Your parents?
Yeah, I feel very fortunate, especially being a parent now and recognizing, I think I feel really fortunate around how engaged they were as parents to us. What I mean by that is there was always a priority to have a family dinner. There was a value on connection and a very supportive environment. I grew up with dyslexia. My brothers were dyslexic. I have a brother with Down syndrome. And the emphasis they put on to give us the adequate support we needed to be successful was incredible. And what it did is I think it really brought forward the importance of being okay with asking for help, really valuing the work ethic rather than the outcome. I so clearly remember my dad saying, "I will never look at a report card. All I care about is that you're giving it the best shot you can." I think we were instilled with this self-belief and these values that have clearly shown up in so many important ways as life has unfolded.
How do you think they knew to do that? What inspired them to be gentle and supportive parents?
I think a lot of it was their upbringing. My dad grew up in Ireland, and I just always remember him talking about his mom and dad always having this belief that you got to believe in the child's ability and not interfere with that, with your own fears or worries or anxieties, but really letting the child learn and maybe fail or whatever that is. But there was just this belief that they were brought up with, that kids can do more than maybe we can sometimes allow them to. That unfolded in a lot of really unique and powerful ways for us.
I agree with you. I think you're very fortunate. That's a lovely way to raise children. And so for brothers, would you say when you were younger, you all loved each other? Did you fight? Were you competitive? What was that like in the house?
Super competitive. So there were four of us, and I'm the second oldest. And then David, who has Down syndrome, is younger than me, and Kevin is the youngest. And there was just always that younger brother, like, I want to do it. Is the older brother's doing it or better? And that just moved down the line. And no matter what it was, if it was ping pong, if it was snowboarding, it was just always, yeah, we always had each other to compete with.
And you grew up in Vermont?
Yep.
Was it just you and Kevin that were in snowboarding, or were you all massively passionate about snowboarding?
So my oldest brother, Andrew, he got us into it. And then he didn't take the competitive route with it. That was more me and Kevin, but he was definitely the person who kind of inspired us to get into it. And at the time, snowboarding was still at its infancy. So I remember Kevin having to write a handwritten letter to Jake Burton saying, my bolder brothers are snowboarding, but you don't make a snowboard my size. And a couple of weeks later, Kevin got a snowboard in the mail for one of the prototypes for the first kids' boards.
That's incredible. So were you and Kevin in snowboarding competitive with one another, or did you notice very quickly that one of you was just naturally a stronger snowboarder, or how did that work?
It was competitive for quite a while until we got pretty serious. And then when Kevin started winning a lot of contests and clearly surpassing my abilities, then it just became more of like, how can I support him? And I remember so vividly, though, this feeling of when he did well and when he would win, I almost felt like I was winning or doing well. So the competitiveness, once he surpassed me in that way, it always felt like the more success for him was success for both of us.
You are such a wonderful human being, because you know that a lot of brothers would have not felt good about the younger brother surpassing them. That was very humble and kind of you. That just shows how supportive you all really were outside of the sport. Were you guys the closest in terms of your interests and friendship?
Yeah, I think so. I think because of our interest in snowboarding.
I'm sure there are a lot of people that may not have heard your story. What happened, this huge event that changed all of your lives quite prolifically? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we got very into competitive snowboarding, and Kevin ended up getting really, really good and became one of the best competitive snowboarders in the world. And he had just come off a year leading into the Olympics where he had pretty much won every contest he had entered. And he had beaten Sean White, who was the favorite. He was the best snowboarder and hadn't had many people beat him. And then Kevin came along and started beating him going into the Olympics. So there was this kind of rivalry happening. And many of us thought Kevin was the favorite to go in and win the Olympics. And then in a training accident in Park City, Utah, leading up to the Olympics, he sustained a severe traumatic brain injury.
And this was 2009.
Yeah, right. It was on New Year's 2009, 2010.
Yeah. He did a flip and fell on his head.
Correct. Yep.
What was that like for you all going through that?
Oh, there were so many stages of deep sadness, uncertainty, hope. We had no idea really what traumatic brain injury was. We really had very little understanding and unclarity of that. So I was in Vermont when it happened. So we had to fly out that day. And I'll never forget the doctor calling my mom on the plane saying, can we have permission to drill a second tube into Kevin's brain to relieve the blood pressure? And we just had no idea what that meant. And he was in a coma, and we didn't know if that was going to be forever, for how long that was going to be. And then fortunately, he started just having progression within the circumstances. And even though they were really small and slow, they were at least progress. And I think we had to do our best to try to live in the present and just believe that he was going to come out of that.
He was in a coma for 2.5 weeks, super scary. And then 26 days, you said, in the ICU. What is a traumatic brain injury? Or let's say, what were the doctors telling you, given that traumatic brain injury is in some ways a global or generic even term? Most are very different from one another, depending on the accident. What were you being told about what a traumatic brain injury was for Kevin at this moment?
An interesting question. I don't think they said he has a TBI and it's this. I think it was more the reality of there is bleeding in his brain and that's creating swelling and that can create significant damage. But really the focus was, can they release the blood and the pressure in his brain? I remember you would see the bag of blood that was coming out of his brain. And sorry, this might be too graphic, but I just remember that the doctors said, the focus right now is we want that to be clear. And for days, we would just watch the color and really just hope that the color would shift. So it almost felt like we had to go through stages. And then when we felt like it was getting better and there was some light at the end of the tunnel, then he would get a blood clot. And then the question of then what happens? And he had to get just so many different things to help him, to feed him, to all of the complexities. So it didn't even feel like we were trying to see TBI for what it was. It was almost just, can we just get through the day and the challenges that we're facing in this moment?
Yeah. You were in the hospital for 26 days with him, taking care of Kevin or watching and waiting. What happened after that?
Yeah, so it was 26 days in the critical care, and then they moved us to acute care for another 2.5 weeks, I believe. And then as things continued to progress, then he got airlifted from Utah to an incredible hospital in Denver called Craig Hospital, where we spent the next 3.5 months doing inpatient therapy.
And when you say we, was your entire family there?
It was a mix of us the whole time. Obviously, people had different responsibilities. I quit my job at the time, so I was there full time with my mom and other brothers and my dad. We had to rotate.
And what were you feeling then? What was this like for you personally, watching your brother go through this and being one of his, I'm not sure if you would call yourself a caregiver, but you were certainly a cheerleader and supporter, activist. What was this like for you?
It was really hard. I remember there was a few things that I had to do early. One was I had puzzles. Puzzles were a huge part for me of just being able to be focused and go internal. I'm definitely an introvert, so finding my own space to just process was important for me. It was so hard because Kevin was quite well known, so there was a lot of media attention. So it was not only trying to manage just our own processing of the experience and trying to give him what we felt like was the space to heal, but then also dealing with just all of the requests. I mean, I remember he had to have like a double, triple X or a zero for his name because of people trying to find where he was. And so there was just a lot of external pressure as well that we had to figure out how to process. It's hard when you go into such a state of shock to be able to describe maybe what it felt like. But I think, again, I was fortunate to have family and support, and the people around us were incredibly supportive to just jump in and take over either insurance or organizing where we were going to go next, or just all of the steps that have to be taken. So many people stepped in to fill that so we could really just process being present with him and really just bringing a positive spirit to his bedside.
And when he started coming back, or you started being able to see Kevin, your brother, the kid that fought with, loved the whole thing, what did that feel like when it's like, oh my gosh, we're getting closer to something that feels like it might be the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, there's a lot in this question that we can unpack as time goes on. But I think the truth is that it's not as if you just come out of the woods and you come into this open field and it's like, oh, there he is again. It's really slow. And there never was like, oh, there he is, like we're back. It's always just, okay, he can finally take a shower by himself, or he can walk. So it was such a slow, gradual process that it almost demands you to not get ahead of yourself, even though your mind is just continuously saying, will he get back to who he was? What do we have to do to get back? The teaching in just that process has been so significant.
So TBI is one of the things, and I think I mentioned this a little bit, and a lot of people talk about this, one of the challenges that people with TBI have is that it's not visible to other people. So as you were going through the healing process, was it hard to see him not be able to do things that looked really easy to you? Like, come on, just take a shower. Come on, just put your fork in your hand properly. How patient did you need to be, or did you have people explaining to you what this was like?
We didn't have anyone giving us the blueprint or what to expect, which made it really hard. And I think we were fortunate to have parents who understood patience and understood how to be in difficulty. That was truly the one thing we leaned on and that helped guided all of us as a family, which was, how do we support each other and communicate in effective ways and figure out what are the things that need to be done to keep moving us forward? We have some real problem solvers in our family aligned with, yeah, people who have a real sense of steadiness and presence and strength. And I think those qualities were what we leaned on because there was so much uncertainty.
What would you say to other people who are going through something like this? For example, I have a friend who has a TBI. She had a car accident many years ago. And even today, so she's fully functional visibly, but she'll say, I just can't organize my cabinets. Or there are certain things that she can't do that are, when you look at her and you see all the things she can do, it's a little confusing. And I think that is one of the confusing things about traumatic brain injury, that there are some things that are harder for one individual that may not be hard for another individual.
When you ask that question, my mind goes to the person who's been impacted, and then also the question to who's around them supporting them. And obviously, Kevin had the accident and his challenges were different than mine. Even though I hadn't experienced a brain injury as a caregiver, I had a lot of things that I needed to work on. I think I just want to ensure that we're looking, when the person is impacted, how you deal with that, because there's such a need of support. The whole family, the whole infrastructure has to also ask that question. But it's so common that when the person gets hurt, all the attention just has to go on that person, really saying, you need to do that rehab, you need to look at yourself, you need to find the patient, all the things. But the reality is that the dynamic changes, the relationship changes, expectations need to change, acceptance of this new person needs to change. And that work is very intense and demands everyone look at that same question.
Yeah, that's really interesting. As you're going through this journey, what was Kevin's motivation? Did he have his snowboarding competition attitude inside of him in terms of healing, or did he have a lot of frustration and setbacks and I'm never going to be the same person kind of thing?
No, his drive was to go back to the Olympics. Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
I remember watching the Olympics with him in his bed and he's just like, I can do that. And just lacked complete awareness of where he was. At the same time, he lacked that awareness, but with the same drive that was what was going to motivate him to spend 10 hours every single day working on all of the rehab that he had to do.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was, I think, fortunately, looking back, having that drive. Yeah, he was fortunate to have that and people around him to delicately continue to work with him to understand what was feasible and also what was going to keep him motivated.
Yeah. Along the way, a doctor told Kevin, and I think this is where the name of your foundation, which we'll talk about in a little while, a doctor said to Kevin, you really need to love your brain. What was he saying that in response to?
I think in the reality of how negative of an experience it is to go through it. And our brains are wired to have negative thoughts, and then compounded by the nature and frustration of brain injury. I think him reminding Kevin that you have to love your brain. There has to be ways you have to see yourself. You have to be able to love yourself. I think it really comes down to that. And I think it's as simple as that. You have to find thoughts. You have to find ways of seeing the things about yourself that are lovable. Because at every moment you're looking in a mirror or being told you are not what you're supposed to be or what you were.
It's pretty incredible to think that, to love your brain when you're feeling like it's such a long journey to get back to where you want to be, who you want to be. and not knowing what that and looks like. Was Kevin learning at that time any self-compassion practices, or were there any other tools that you were employing to help him love himself, love his brain?
This is where the work that we started doing came from, was him actually going into a yoga class. I think it was the first time where he could do something both physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, that didn't make him feel less than or like he needed to be something other than he was. And I just so vividly remember him coming out of that first yoga class, just vibrantly, he seemed like a different person.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really interesting. And he talks about it. He says that no matter you going into therapy or whatever, the message your brain is telling you is that you're not good enough, or you're not where you need to be or want to be. But so finally to be in a space where he could just be where he was and connected to that, I think was maybe the first time he had started to enter that space of reflection or self-inquiry.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle.
Yeah.
How long after that did you decide to start the foundation, Love Your Brain Foundation?
It took a few years. 2 years after his injury, we ended up creating, we made a documentary called The Crash Reel with an amazing filmmaker, Lucy Walker, and HBO, that really brought to light for us the complexity and prevalence of TBI around the world. What it did to us was see the significance of the isolation that comes from TBI, as well as the magnitude of different challenges it presents. Just within that process, I think what we realize is that even though our intention with the film was to create awareness and inspire and bring hope for people dealing with challenges like this, furthermore, just exacerbated, hey, we have to figure out how we can support these millions of people dealing with the ongoing challenges that TBI presents. And it took us a few years of really trying to listen to what was working for Kevin and what other people were bringing forward to us to try to figure out how could we be useful.
And was Kevin fully on his way to recovery when you guys, because you and Kevin started this, correct? Or how did that work?
Yeah. I want to bring attention to the word you just used, recovery, because what we've learned in this process is that recovery means return to who you were. And many of us who have had an injury like a broken bone, we think recovery. We go into the hospital, we get it fixed, it heals, we recover. And the reality with brain injury is that if all of your energy and thinking is only directed to getting back to what was, and the reality of that is not happening as fast as you want or is going to happen again, the reality of that, as you can imagine, is failure or challenge or suffering of consistency. And what we learned, and I'll never forget the moment that we were on a stage, Kevin and I were doing a speaking engagement, and a doctor said, "Kevin, what makes you so resilient?" And in that moment, he looked at me and was, "I have no idea." And yet you could just see this person who was just extremely willing to keep bouncing back and keep figuring out how to move forward. Now, was that in the same way he was? No, but what it showed was that this is about resilience. This is actually about how do you get up and keep going and not have the attention and focus on what was, but rather that what are the steps in progress you can see to move forward. And that moment, and when I say we had to spend years thinking about and listening to what actually was happening, those little details and those importances were huge in us understanding, well, what does Love Your Brain look like? What is actually supporting someone to move forward in this process look like? And I know for us, when you can just reframe your mindset in just that simple way, how much it opens up for healing and opportunity.
So what does Love Your Brain mean?
I think it means probably different things to everyone, but to me, it means really what it says. It means finding a way to love yourself. And how you do that is what the foundation works to do.
I really relate to what you're saying for a lot of people, because in any transition, whether we have a traumatic brain injury or not, we might lose a part of ourselves. You have cancer, you have physical injuries, you may not be exactly the way you were before, but this idea of being in the moment and being in the shoes that you're in right now and loving that, it seems really important across a lot of different situations.
Absolutely. I ended up going to India and doing a 10-day silent Vipassana retreat, and the practice is just being attuned to the sensations in your bodies. And the meditation was 14 to 16 hours a day. You were just sitting, paying attention to the rising and passing of sensation. And the perspective I left with, which with a lot of what you're just talking about, which is our attunement to change. And I think we can get so caught in this idea that things are permanent and they need to be that way. And if they're not that way, we suffer. Rather than being able to be with the ever-changing nature of life and finding a way to be more in tune and accepting of that. That was my aha moment as my relationship was being challenged with Kevin, to say, rather that Kevin was this imperfect thing that needed to be a certain way and it wasn't, and that was the cause of our suffering, rather looking internally and saying, whoa, how am I actually relating to this change? And that's the problem. It's my inability to accept this changing nature of what is. That was such a major moment of my transformative understanding of this reality and really the practice that it takes to actually live into that.
I'm in, I don't know if this is the right word, but in awe of you, how you supported your brother and how much you changed along the way. Going to a 10-day Vipassana retreat in India is not easy for anyone. And that just shows how much you were in this whole journey for yourself, understanding yourself, helping Kevin. He's so lucky to have you as a brother. Do you meditate every day now? Yes, that's a commitment for you.
It is, yeah. And it might not look like necessarily sitting on the mat every day, but finding ways to be present. Simple things as just feeling the door handle as I leave the house, or finding moments of gratitude. Things that can establish an awareness of the present moment for me is what meditation looks like. And sometimes that's sitting for longer, sometimes that's not. But tapping into that space, absolutely. And it helps that our work revolves around that space as well.
Tell me a little bit about the foundation, the mission and the curriculum of the Love Your Brain Foundation.
So the mission is to improve the lives of people with brain injury. And we do that through programs that have been scientifically proven to enhance resilience and connection. And as I mentioned, the most common thing you hear with people with brain injury is the feeling of being isolated. So we think about our programs as a space where collective resilience can happen, where you can show up to a room and not have to explain the challenges you're going through. There's a common understanding in that space of the challenges, the complexities, the understanding of what it feels like to have a brain injury, and then have designed curriculums that support people to navigate what those complexities are. So those show up in a variety of ways. We have in-person retreats, we have online programs, we have trainings where we teach yoga teachers, clinicians, and people with brain injuries how to adapt yoga and specifically modify it to support people with symptoms that are challenged by brain injury. And then we also, as I said, we lead research in understanding how these modalities can improve the lives of people with brain injury.
That's amazing. And you see a lot of progress. Do people stay connected after the retreats? Are you building a larger community of people who can support each other?
We are. It's incredible, really. And as I mentioned, when you give someone the space to feel seen and understood, it's like giving them an Advil when they have an ache back. It feels like we're almost like prescribing wellness without having to give a pill or a medicine. And I think with all the research you see coming out around social isolation, especially with the pandemic and people really feeling the result of that, for people with TBI, they would say, well, this is what it feels like to have a brain injury. This feeling of things being different, not feeling connected to people in the same way. This is all the same stuff. So the reality is, it's like, how can we ensure that people can find a place where the space allows them to feel connected in a real way, and then give them tools that allow them to look at themselves and have more tools for the tool bag.
So great that you have created this platform for TBI people. One of the statistics I read somewhere in your materials was that 87% of prison inmates might have TBI. And you and Kevin are doing work in prisons now. So I'm just curious about that whole, is that statistic correct? What is your work in prisons?
Yeah, I don't know if the statistic is exactly right, but I will say it's an incredibly high prevalence. Many years ago, we partnered with the Tribeca Film Institute and worked with them and a few inmates in some super maximum prisons to create a curriculum based on the crash reel that would support inmates with brain injury to look at their situation and work through this curriculum. And it was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had. We were with majority of inmates who were in for life and also had a relatability to the reality of head injuries. And it was really hard to see, because you would hear them share their stories and see the results of family abuse, trauma at very early ages leading to the reasons of some of these horrific things happening. But really, the results of head injuries being such a part of these stories and realities, and having no support and no understanding, and seeing people in these positions where, yeah, it was just heartbreaking. But it was also incredibly amazing to be able to relate to human beings who had caused so much suffering, who had gone through so much suffering, in just a very real and open way. For us, it was just like, you see the homeless populations, you see veterans, you see so many people living with these invisible injuries. And we often hear these stories of people causing these challenges or whatever they are. And often the result is brain damage. And yet there's such a lack of support, there's such a lack of funding that there's this reality. And I think we're committed to continuing to find all of the different populations where there are these intersections that limit access or support to move through this suffering with care and with tools that, yeah, lead to a lot of challenge. So it's part of our mission is to figure out how do we continuously support so many different groups who have less resources or access to this care.
So you guys are trying together get out into the community as much as you can.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I saw that Kevin goes into schools, and maybe you do too. And he's like, I know your mom tells you to wear a helmet and you probably don't sometimes, but I'm here to tell you, wear a helmet. That's what saved my life. So it's nice that you both have become advocates for loving your brain, really. What about this idea I saw in the film, your family having a conversation around Kevin wanting to go back to compete with snowboarding. What happened with that?
Yeah, well, as I said, it was this delicate balance of wanting him to find the drive and motivation to do that. And we wanted him to get back to do the things that he loved and that would fill him up, because as we all know, what we all want, but to do it in a way where we could calculate the risk that was involved. And there was one instance where he went to a contest that luckily was low risk, but he did it without telling anyone. And it was actually the first time where I think he saw his injury, because he got on a snowboard and was not able to do what he normally did. And as much as we could tell him that, it wasn't going to resonate until he could feel it, which was a really pivotal moment in his understanding, his willingness to continue to work hard and find ways to support, yeah, the different elements that he was challenged by.
So did he go back into competition, or was that a profound moment of, you know what, I can do other things that are going to give me joy?
Yeah, he didn't go back to competing like he did. And it definitely continued to drive him, though, to want to get back on a snowboard just in different ways. His eyes were really impacted, so he would see double vision. And as you can imagine, snowboarding is bumpy and it would make having good vision important. So that challenged him. But when he could find getting into like deeper powder where there was less of the jiltiness, then his eyes were better. But really, I mean, I remember 9 years into his healing, he would be waking us up juggling and doing eye exercises just day after day after day to continue to try to get single vision, which he has now. And he went through eye surgeries and doctors around the country saying he'd never have single gaze. And he was just not willing to hear no, or it wasn't going to happen.
Your family is amazing. And I'm sure that's part of why he was so devoted to whatever recovery means in any moment. I think that's probably why. What would you say you have learned most along this journey? Because your life has changed profoundly. I don't know what you were planning to do before this happened. Maybe you can share a little bit. Did you have a career goal, or what was it you thought you wanted to do with your life, and how has that changed for you?
Well, I was not in a place where I knew what I wanted in my life in terms of profession or clarity of what that looked like. So that wasn't as of major of like a shift in my life. But I think what it did is it got me closer to seeing just how adversity and suffering can be a greater pathway to finding meaning and growth. And that didn't happen overnight in any way. But I think over time, what it's done for me is it's given me such a different ability to be with challenge and be with difficulty and be with joy. It's probably hard for someone to understand that who hasn't maybe gone through that, or vice versa, or I think other people can relate to that. But I really feel that the sense of connection you can build through vulnerability and through challenge is so much more meaningful and deeper than often without it. Not that I wish it upon anyone or think people need to go through it to find it, but it can offer that, which I think is a very important dimension of it.
Tell me about your partnership with Muse and how you've used it.
Yeah. So many years ago, we did an event in LA and we had an incredible musician, Trevor Hall, play a show, and we did it in this incredible studio, and Muse became a sponsor of the event. And it was really cool because we had the band set up at the event where people could come in and sit for 10 minutes and meditate and put this band on that would start to give them more awareness of what their mind was doing and some simple tasks and how you could work and focus to get your mind to maybe not be so distracted or busy. And that's where this relationship started. And now, yeah, it's exciting to be working with them to understand how a relationship between an organization like them that has a technology that supports a very big focus of ours, which is how do we support people with brain injury to meditate and use that as a tool for healing.
That's fantastic. Are there any other thoughts you'd like to share with us before we close? I like to ask people, what three pieces of advice would you give your younger self right now?
The first would be lean into vulnerability. And I love Brené Brown's definition of vulnerability, which is risk plus uncertainty plus emotional exposure. And I think when we have the courage to be vulnerable it can unlock so much of our suffering and our challenge and connect us in such a deep, profound way. So that would be one. Two would be patience, continuously finding tools to cultivate patience. And the third is finding space where you can quiet your mind and open your heart.
I love that. Thank you for being so thoughtful about those. Is there anything else you want to share before we close?
No, I appreciate just the expansiveness of your questions and the thoughtfulness around them. I think that we've covered many aspects of this, and continuously I feel every day we're learning and we're growing and we're evolving as people and as an organization. So just appreciative that you've brought attention and awareness to this space, because as you said in the beginning, this is an invisible injury, and the more we can talk about it and have a greater understanding, then the more visibility there is.
Thank you, Adam. I am in, as I said, awe of you, your support of your brother, your ability to grow in the face of this really challenging journey. It's amazing. It is amazing. I know why CNN called you their hero. You're a hero. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. Find out more about the Love Your Brain Foundation and the partnership with Muse at loveyourbrain.com. The HBO film is called Crash Reel and is available on streaming services. You can also see the segment about Adam on CNN Heroes at the link in the show notes. Any questions, suggestions, comments, reach out to us at untangle@choosemuse.com. And we'd love if you'd write a review for us. It helps a lot. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.